So, little trivia. Once Moses is born, the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' valedictory address. He teaches the Israelites what they'll need to know going forward after his death. And so from the time he's born till the book of Deuteronomy, how many parshiot do not feature Moses? Just one. This is the only one that doesn't have Moses' name. In the parsha of Balaam and Balak, he's not featured very much, which leads to my rabbi to make some interesting midrashim about that. But our sages ask about this, and I talked about this once in our Beit Midrash. Our sages have a lot of interesting ways of understanding the calendar. They understand that this Shabbat would likely have been Moses' yahrzeit. I just want you to know that that's something they've calculated, not something that I adhere to. So I say that it's odd, the Litzker Rav says that it's odd that this would be the parsha that doesn't feature Moses, when it might have been read either linked to his birthday or even his yahrzeit. And the Baal HaTurim, Jacob ben Asher, notes that, you know, this is the only time, once he's born until Deuteronomy, where he's omitted. So what he sets it upon, and it's commonly arrived upon, is that in the next parasha, when the Israelites have the transgression of the molten calf, Moses will say to God, if you don't let me rescue them, erase me from your book. Take me out of the book. I can't be a party to a story where the Israelites can't be saved from their transgression. So, of course, God relents, but our sages consider that when a righteous person like Moses makes a vow like that, it has to be fulfilled in small measure. So this is the place where he was erased. So this led me to Avi Strauss. I meant to invite him because I wanted him to hear this sermon. It was partly inspired by a topic we were discussing, sort of a mystical topic called Bitul HaYesh, the annulment of the Yesh is really just existence, but it's intended to describe the abnegation of one's ego, Bitul HaYesh. You might call it humility, but it's more of a mystical sort of Zen concept of literally disappearing, of scratching oneself out of the parsha, so to speak. And that's, I think, one of our sages' optimistic ideas about how we can combat the difficulties in life, that a form of modesty and ego effacement and humility can help us get through. So another thing that's noted about this parasha and why Moses might not be in it, at least by name, although he's addressed directly, so he's not far, is that just a few weeks ago, Moses was given the vision of the tabernacle. And then Moses set out contractors, Bezalel and Oholiab, to build it. And eventually his brother Aaron and Aaron's sons would officiate therein. You know, maybe what's imagined by our sages is that Moses thought he would be the one to work and to purvey over the tabernacle. And that would be a joyful occasion for him. But instead, he became the nominal, the titular political leader, the teacher of the people. In some ways much harder, in some ways without the joys of barbecue. And, you know, as you read in Torah, the priests get a lot of perquisites, not just food, but attention and attendance from other tribes because they aren't landed in the same way. So what Bitul HaYesh seems to suggest to us is that one of the ways that we get past our disappointments and moreover our resentments is through effacement, through stepping back from ourselves. C.S. Lewis said, the author C.S. Lewis said, I think very truly, the humility is not about thinking less of yourself. It is about thinking of yourself less. Humility doesn't mean that you think, oh, I'm such a terrible person. That's actually kind of a converse form of arrogance. I'm the terrible thing around which the world revolves. That's not humility. But humility is a kind of drawing one's attention outward to others, to other needs, to other people, and creating through that space, creating through the joy perhaps Moses might have felt of watching his brother and nephews serve in the tabernacle that he envisioned. A joy to watch them succeed. The joy Moses might have felt in watching Bezalel and Aholiab build the thing that he had. He wasn't exactly the architect, maybe the draftsman for the tabernacle. Proverbs says that fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of holy matters is an understanding. So drawing oneself out of one's narrow space, one's egocentrism, one's thoughts about oneself, is hard. It's hard. My mother used to give the advice when I would be in a difficult moment, think about how worse it could be. Think about homeless people. And I think what she was trying to say, I may have relayed this to you before, was not, it could always be worse, because that's actually not so fulfilling or satisfying emotionally. It could always be worse, but as Proverbs also says, only the heart knows its own bitterness, that everyone's grief is unique and distinct and unshareable. I think what she was offering and what's offered by our tradition is thinking about other people, serving other people, looking outside ourselves can draw us away from our own griefs and frustrations. So Sartre says in No Exit towards the end, he says, l'enfer c'est les autres. Hell is other people. Which I think, I only bring that to you because I think that's not Jewish. I think Judaism thinks that heaven is other people. I think in this parsha and elsewhere, Judaism would tell you that the way to live a dignified life, the way to be happy, frankly, in this life, not just to preserve for yourself a space in the world to come, but the way to make your own life satisfying and fulfilling is through service of others, is through being among others, is through getting out of one's own head. I mean, that's what Pitulei Esh really is. Ego effacement is really just getting out of your head, stopping the train of thinking that is so focused on your own tsuris, your own worries, your own concerns, that you can't live. So we see, I guess, Moses bequeaths to his nephews the service in temple and tabernacle. And other parts of the parasha are about their service. So maybe one could say that this parasha doesn't treat on Moses so it can view the things that Moses hath wrought. So we're told in chapter 28 that they must hakrev, draw near. The word for sacrifice is related to the word for drawing close, for drawing intimate, for becoming intimate with another. It's the same root, at least in modern Hebrew. So the Dubno Magid, one of the early sages of the Hasidic movement, notes the main job of the Levites, of the priests, was to atone for the Israelites, to bring their sacrifices such to rectify the ethical balances in the Israelite kingdom. So for them to atone for Israel's transgressions, says the Dubno Magid, they must be near to and mixed among the sinners. As you know, our tradition doesn't think much of the ivory tower. You know, there were rabbis, it seemed to be a mold in a certain era, maybe the 1950s, of the rabbi being in his ivory tower, you know, sitting behind a big and imposing desk. What was the Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man, that showed the generations of the rabbis, and the most senior rabbi had the largest desk that was the most imposing. But that, I think, is anathema and anomalous to the Jewish tradition of rabbis and sages and Levites and Jewish leaders and Jewish thinkers sharing in the work of Judaism. Some of my favorite sages, philosophers of Judaism in the 20th century, Jacob Agus, Louis Jacobs, were rabbis of very successful congregations in Baltimore and London, respectively. Heschel less so. Heschel was not good with people, we're told. But you have to draw near to people. That's how you get out of yourself. That's how you become more fully living. And when you do that, I think there is, among other places in our Torah, is one of the places where we're sort of offered eternal life. Not necessarily the life of the world to come, olam haba, but an eternity, the way Woody Allen would say it. You know, I don't want to be immortal for my art. I actually want to live forever. So that's, I think, what's offered when we're described about Aaron in a few different places, both in Numbers and Exodus, as lighting the lamps and burning the incense. and he does it eternally. So our sages says, you know, that can't, we're not reading this right. That can't be what it means, because Aaron doesn't live forever. But what we're told is that Aaron did it himself, and that it was as if he lit them his whole life. You know, even when his children would be the one doing the work, standing in for him when he had a stomach bug. I think they're not exactly denying the tamid, the always, the eternity of it. I think though the phrase says Aaron did it and it went on eternally, and the sages quickly understand, well, it wasn't always Aaron doing it. I think what they're saying is, because Aaron was a Levite whose work it was to satiate the people, to atone for their sins, to help balance the scales of justice among the Israelites, because that was the Levites and the priests' job, they gained a certain eternal life in the world. As John Adams would say, the influence of each person on others in this life is a kind of immortality. So I wish that for you this Shabbat, that you can levatel hayesh, annul yourself enough to work and serve others.